Today is June 13th, 2017, and my name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, and I'm most pleased to be talking with a wonderful musician, artist, sculptor, dancer, founder and lead singer of Jefferson Airplane, winner of multiple awards, including Grammy, Lifetime Achievement Award, creator of platinum and gold records, and inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and longtime Mill Valley resident. I'm speaking today with Marty Ballin. Marty, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy life to sit and talk with the Mill Valley Historical Society.
Oh, my pleasure, Zebra. My pleasure.
Marty, I'm a woman of a certain age, and I have to say that I think some of the most poignant moments of my life have been accompanied by your beautiful music. And so first of all, I just want to say thank you for that. Thank you for bringing a little bit of your creativity into all of our lives.
Oh, my pleasure.
Marty, to get a little context, do you mind telling me just a little bit about your family, your parents, your grandparents? Yeah.
And well, my dad was a photographer, and my mom was just a housewife, but, you know, quite a force of nature. And he worked from San Jose up to Contra Costa, Oakland, and then we moved to Frisco, and mainly grew up there. And he worked all the, you know, big plants.
He was what?
Excuse me. And I just we came to San Francisco when I was about four, I think.
4 years old in San Francisco. What year were you born, Marty?
1942.
So you're coming into San Francisco in the close to the late 40s. Must have been, do you recall what it was like as a child in San Francisco, and what part of San Francisco did you live in?
Well, we first just lived in the Tenderloin. I have a picture on my wall of the first day that we arrived in San Francisco. We were walking down Market Street, and they had a photographer, and he would take pictures of families, and he'd give you a card, and, you know, and I have that picture. I was about 4 years old. My sister, my mother, my father, walking down Market Street. First day we came to San Francisco.
Wow.
Very interesting.
Does that picture, when you look at it, evoke memories for you of your childhood in San Francisco?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, growing up from San Francisco, we moved over to Contra Costa, just past Richmond. Then we moved up to Richmond, lived there for years, and then we came across the bay to San Francisco.
Richmond, what was Richmond like for you? What years were you there? Do you remember?
Well, I went to junior high, and it was good years for me. It was, you know, growing up, you know, the age of the teenage rebellion years, and rock and roll was dying, and all that was kind of exciting. And Richmond was quite, you know, quite a little place at that time. Very black oriented place. I had a lot of friends, and had some exciting times delivering newspapers there. I remember doing projects and singing with black guys. It was kind of fun.
So were you singing from an early age? Was this something that
Yeah, my mother said I sang, I whistled before I talked. But,
you whistled before you talked?
Yeah.
That's sweet.
But my mom said even today I'll be in shopping and people go, oh, you're a happy guy. And I noticed I was humming or singing a melody or something in my head. But I find myself always, you know, playing with tunes.
I guess that just was your natural born gift, huh?
Yeah, I just, you know, got a song in my heart.
Yeah, you got a song in your heart. Oh, that's sweet. So now you're in San Francisco during the beatnik era then.
Yeah, right? That was great.
Tell me about that.
That was a fun time. Well, I grew up in the era when, in fact, I was good friends with Ralph Mathis, who was Johnny Mathis's brother. He was one of his brothers. And we were the same age, Ralph and I, and we hung out together. I used to hang out at Johnny Mathis's house over on, 32nd, near going up the park to the Legion of Honor, I remember.
32nd Street? You mean Johnny Mathis, the singer? Am I getting
yeah.
this? Oh, my.
Yeah, family lives there, and Ralph was there with his mother and father, and Johnny was coming to stay there, and Alice Payne's and his cool suits, everything, which Ralph and I would borrow and wear, because we would go down to Broadway and hit the little jazz clubs and try to get a chance to get up and sing with the trio or something, you know. So we'd wear his suits. It just fit perfectly.
You were wearing Johnny Mathis's super slick, interesting, and awesome clothes?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you must have felt like $1 million.
Oh, yeah, we did. We looked up.
Yeah. Well, and so you were singing then in clubs. You were jumping in where you could with it. And did Ralph sing with you?
No, Ralph had his own thing. He had made records, and he wished that I had his own style. And he just never pursued it, I guess. But I don't know what happened to him.
Huh, you lost touch over time, huh?
Well, you know, one time I loved the guy so much, and I was in L.A. I was a big deal in the airport at the time, living in this mansion in the Hollywood Hills, and I researched where Ralph was, and I found out he was in Hollywood, and he was a preacher. So I went to his house, and I went and knocked on the door, and because I was a hippie with, you know, wild clothes and long hair and beads, and, you know, he was offended by me and the publicity that we had gotten being kings of acid and your mother's worst nightmare, stuff like that. You know, he was really not very friendly to me, and I was really excited about getting him a contract, but he was offended. I even came to his house. So that didn't work out at all.
Did that hurt?
Yeah, it did, but, you know, I went.
Yeah.
I haven't been in this business and not been hurt by almost everybody I've worked with.
Yes, I suppose so.
You know, I'm kind of used to it.
And you're at the vanguard of a rock and roll era change, and I guess you probably offended... You have a wake of offended mothers and fathers and preachers behind you.
I played with people, and they would come up to me and say, you know, I wanted to come see you when I was a kid at the old Fillmore or the Winterland, and my mother went up me, and my kids now are in you, and they brought me here tonight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, oh, well, it's about time, you know.
Interesting. So you're growing up, you come to San Francisco as a young boy, you have a momentous opportunity to have that photo taken of you and your family that very first day, you settle in, you kind of travel around the Bay a bit, get acquainted with lots of different areas of the Bay, end up back in San Francisco, hanging out with, you know, close to the fringe of some pretty famous people. I mean, Johnny Mathis was big. And then
oh, yeah, man. He would have parties at his house with all the great jazz people, jazz singers. You know, it was quite something. And everybody would, you know, get up and sing and dance around, even little kids and grandmas. And, you know, black people are just so much looser. And in fact, Johnny was one of the first guys who said to me, "Hey, kid, you ought to try singing. You know, you got a pretty good voice." That was the first pro I ever gave me some confidence.
Did you ever think you were meant to be a singer? I mean, when he said that, did that?
Oh yeah, I always liked singing. When I quit working, my father tried to get me to be a printer and have a profession in mythography too. And I worked all these big presses in downtown Frisco, and I just said not for me. He kept promoting me up, and when he finally put me in the office, and I said, "I gotta get out of here." And I said, "What do I want to do? What do I like to do?" And I said, "You know, I like to sing. I know it's odd, but of all the things I've ever done, I like to sing. It's something that's so real for me." Mm-hmm. "And I think I'll give it a try." So, that's what I did. I said, "Hey, no looking back."
So how did you go about it? When you decided, this is what I want to do, you're in San Francisco, what were your next steps?
Well, I was living with a couple of folk guys who were singing and playing folk. And they had a teacher, a guitar teacher, Larry Vargo, who came, and I was singing with him. And he took me down to the old drinking gourd on Union Street in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have hoot nannies and sing-alongs and all that. And he organized a group, a folk group, I was in at the drinking gourd called the Town Criers. And we played around all over California and Hawaii and Nevada. It was a lot of fun, and we even played the old Hungry Eye, the old Purple Onion Jazz Workshop, all those great clubs,
Mm-hmm.
But that was my first real exposure.
Did you wear what were the clothes that you wore? I remember some of those bands, they all dressed in kind of a band uniform. Did you dress that way too with your band?
Well, they had, a couple times they had these women who would come and wanted to dress us and, make us all look in pastel colors or something. And, we just refused to do it. We were, in that early folk era, so you wore what you want,
Yeah, you wore what you want.
Yeah, and it wasn't anything fancy,
Uh-huh. And so you're getting a taste in... Did it feel, at that time, did you think that you would be doing anything else, or was that just it for you? You knew you were where you wanted to be.
Well, I was singing and having fun doing that. And, that was my fun until I broke up. And then I decided I went to pursue singing and work with a drummer and electric guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began organizing a bunch of people in a band. And but I went back to Hungry Eye and Purple Onion, and I couldn't get hired because we were so loud, with the electricity and the drums and everything. So they didn't like it at all. I couldn't get hired anywhere.
So the Hungry Eye and the Purple Onion, you said?
Yeah.
Those were smaller venues, were they?
They were popular nightclubs in Frisco.
Mm-hmm.
And, we played there, with all kinds of great people.
Didn't you... go on.
I couldn't get any work because I went electric and drums. And we were kind of, playing rock and roll, my version. And so I decided to open my own club and where I could be, play anything I wanted and do what I wanted to do, which was electric and drums and just have a regular band, So I was playing the drinking gourd. I had my own special night, and these nurses would come, and they would watch me in my set and be fans of mine. And one time they brought their boyfriends, and I was talking to the boyfriends during the break, and each one said they had $3,000, and they were looking to invest it. And so I jumped up and I said, "Hey, give it to me." And they said, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "I'll open a nightclub, and you can have the club, and I'll open a band with it, and I'll keep the band." And they said, "Okay."
How much money altogether was that? Each one of the boyfriends had $3,000?
Yeah, it was four of them.
So you had enough, and you basically, and these are absolute strangers, and you're saying, like, "Wait, I know what. We'll open up a club. You run the club, I'll do the music, and that'll be that."
Yeah. And I went around a couple weekends after that to different bars and clubs, and I found this one place that was not doing too well all weekend. So I told these guys, "I think you could get that license there." So it became the Matrix. And as we were working on it, you know, other people came out of the woodwork looking for a place to play their own music and do what they were doing, you know. I mean, you know, Big Brother and All In Company, Jazz Stop, and, you know, Grateful Dead, who were the Warlocks at that time, you know. And people would just come in while I was working on a place and say, "Hey, I play a cello. Could I do a set here?" And I would say, "Yeah." And I put these people on, and we mainly we hire a blues guy. We hired some great Lightning Hopkins and people like that, and the Airplane was forming them, and it would play with these old blues guys, you know. So we're doing about the 15.5 bar blues and stuff like that. It was kind of fun.
So you're basically, you captured a niche right at the right time, right? It seems you're in the process. You haven't even got the building together, called the Matrix, like the movie Matrix.
Yeah.
How interesting. So while you're building it, people are.
The funny thing was, we went around. We put stickers all over town. Says Jefferson Airplane loves you. You know, and I think people wanted to know what a Jefferson Airplane was. Because the opening night of the Matrix, the place was packed, and almost every record company was sitting in the audience offering me a contract. That's so, how immediate successful it was.
I'm sort of speechless. We're going to backtrack in a minute to figure, I'd like to know how it is that you met the other band members, but you literally, while you're opening up your club, while you're in the process of physically putting together, people are coming to you. Great bands, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Grateful Dead, all these bands saying, Steve Miller, and they want this place to play their electric music, and you're like, sure, come on over.
Yeah, right.
And then you decide to, whose idea was it to put stickers that said Jefferson Airplane loves you all over? I mean, that's kind of brilliant promotion, really.
It was my dad friends on my thing. You know, they were hard to take off, too.
Say that again, I'm sorry?
They were hard to take off.
Oh, the adhesive.
Yeah, those early stickers you could put on your bumpers, remember?
Yes, right. I remember. Once it was on forever.
Yeah.
So Jefferson Airplane was adhesively attached to San Francisco. You tattooed San Francisco with that, basically.
Well, the city, you know, was a great support to whatever went on at that club. It was amazing. It just wasn't my band. It was people I played, I would go, you know, nights I wasn't playing, and it just grew, you know.
I have to ask, I've always wondered, where did the name Jefferson Airplane come from?
Well, Joel McCalkin, the guitar player, had a friend of his, the talk partner, who had a dog named Thomas Jefferson Airplane. And one time, we were looking for a name, and the owner just turned and said, why don't we call it Jefferson Airplane? And we all just fell out laughing, you know, thought it was the most hilarious thing. But as we asked the people, they all too thought it was great, you know. So we said, okay, Jefferson Airplane. That's the spirit we want to convey.
So your band is named after a dog with a rather lofty name, Thomas Jefferson Airplane.
Right.
That's funny. That's so funny. That's great. Now, how did you
remember that song that Tom and his fat angel, and he's talking about fly airplane. At the end, he goes, "Fly, Jefferson Airplane, fly." He was talking to the dog who was in the studio from that guy, the guitar player.
Oh.
It was funny.
Oh.
He just calls out and left on track.
Fly, Jefferson Airplane. Wow, that's really good. Interesting.
Yeah,
to
it was
know.
A good little plug for us.
Wow. How did you meet your band members? Because did you have your band when you started?
I was looking for a 12-string. Because when I was in folk, I worked with a 12-string player. And I loved the 12-string. And so I needed to find a 12-string player to do what I wanted. And they would have open auditions at the Drinking Gourd once a week. And I would go down and watch the people audition. And this one guy came up with a 6 in one hand and a 12 in the other. And he wanted to audition. And the doorman, I was standing by the doorman, fortunately, he said, oh, we're all full up. I said, hey, give him my spot. I got to see this guy. So the funniest thing, this guy, Paul Cantner, he gets up to do his bit, and he opens his case, takes his time, like he always did, you know, pulls out his guitar, makes sure it's tuned up, you know, takes his time, and then he looks out there and he goes, I can't do this. He pushes his guitar away, and he goes off stage. And I said to myself, that's the guy. That's the guy I want to work with right there. So I went backstage, and I introduced myself, and I said, hey, I want to get together and play with you. And he said, what, you know? I said, no, let's share some ideas, you know? So he agreed, and I went over to his house, and we went over different ideas we had and traded off. And the first day we were there, down the stairs came this guy, Joel McCalkin, with a guitar case, and his wife. They went downstairs out the door. I said, hey, who's that, Paul? And he said, oh, that's Joel McCalkin. He's the guitar teacher. I said, wow, we should ask him to be in a band, because he looked fantastic. He looked like every lead guitar player should look like, you know. He was just great. And Paul said, oh, no, he's really good. He's too good for us. I said, no, Paul, that's what we want. We want really good people, you know. So I called him and went to bug him and went by his house and even picked him up the first few times and drove him to a rehearsal, you know, just to get him interested. You know, he was a hard nut to crack. But he was helpful in that we were playing we couldn't find a right bass player. And then he said, you know, I used to play with a guitar player in Washington, D.C., Jack Cassidy, who went to bass. And he was a great guitar player. He's probably a good bassist. So we decided to call Jack up. He was in college. And we call him up and wake him up every time. And he'd get up and go, wait a minute. You hear him go to sink, wash his face and hands, come back and say, what? So we tell him about this matrix club we were building. And we're going to, you know, have a great success. And then we need a great bass player. He said, I'd come out and check it out. And we were making $300 a week each, which was a big lie. We weren't making a thing. So he came out, and I was at the Matrix. They brought him to the Matrix, and he had this hair over one eye like Hitler, and a big handlebar mustache, and wearing his old Penny shirts from Penny's or something. And he looked like the biggest dog I ever saw. But he started to play. I said, you want to chart the chords or anything? He said, no, just I'll follow along. So we started to play songs, and he was it, you know. Because I grew up around the jazz clubs, and I knew great bass players, you know, from the jazz trios and jazz clubs. And this guy was great, and he was unique. And that's just what I was looking for. And he was powerful. So he decided to hang it and do it with. And that was great. That was a big benefit, because he liked James, bass player, you know.
So you basically, listen to this story, I'm gathering that you see Paul Kantner, you give him your spot when it's time to perform, right? And
yeah.
He chokes. He doesn't even perform.
Yeah.
Yet you
right.
follow after him for some reason and say, you're the guy. And then
right.
basically, then there's another guy that goes walking past, looking hipper than hip, slick
yeah.
as can
well,
I've
always been an intuition person.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm getting to. I mean, it seems that, logically, you never even played music with these people, but in your mind, you say, this is the one.
Yeah, I just seem to know the right person, you know.
Are you a kind of an...
I'm a good collaborator. You know, I can bring people's music out and, get them involved. I enjoy musicians so much, and I love to hear what they do, especially with my songs.
Wow, that's interesting. I don't know much about musicians or music, really, but do many musicians really work from that instinctual sort of non-thinking place where you just...
I think some do, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you try to, you get yourself into a inspirational state. You can, wait for it to come or try to work at it every day. I'm not really much of a work at it every day guy. I kind of... go with the moon. When the moon gets full, I get working.
So, okay,
no, it's true. I feel the moon. When the moon gets full, I get high energy. I love to perform when the moon is full.
Oh, interesting. So you're now, you've got your band, you've got Jefferson Airplane, and you're performing, and there are a lot of other great bands at that time as well. So
yeah.
You're living in San Francisco, and it's basically the birth of rock and roll is happening right there, and you're part of the egg that's hatching in every way, correct?
Yeah, it was great.
So
exciting.
What was it?
Very exciting.
Tell me about what that was like, just the ambience, I mean, from your perspective as a young person. What did that feel like?
Well, it was very exciting, you know, because people were like... doing great things, like the clothes we wore were handmade. Poster scene, the light shows, the magazines, the music, And then, after we met Bill Graham, we got the ballrooms opening, and we had all these great places to play and to go hear others play, So it was quite a scene in San Francisco. You didn't want to leave it. You know?
Did you feel like you were in a world of your own making, in a way?
Oh, yeah. I felt I was in Nevada, mm-hmm. And I was part of a great movement of this West Coast music that was happening.
Who were some of your favorite performers back then?
Oh, God, I love jazz, Jazz was a monster. And Jim Morrison and I were good friends, and I thought he was brilliant. And Garcia and I were friends, and in the early days, I used to just stand in front of the stage and listen to Garcia just take me up to heaven, you know. But that was before I got in smack, I mean. Mm-hmm. But, you know, guys, there was, you know, we had great people like Otis Redding, you know, get to play with them, and Jimi Hendrix got to play with them, you know, The Who, and, you know, all these great people, Buffalo Blues Band, my God, you know. And Graham, he would have the weirdest shows. Sometimes he would have us play with Vladimir Zinsky, the Russian poet, and flamenco guitar player or something. You know, he would mix things up, you know, some orchestra or something. You know, he would really have interesting builds of different acts. And it worked, you know, it was interesting.
Wow, interesting. So a lot of the bands were living in San Francisco. Where were you living? Were you living with your band?
I was living in the Haight, Maine. And then I ended up in the airplane had a mansion on Fulton Street. And we all ended up in there one time, actually. You know, for some, I think Grace had a fire in her place, and Yama got, couldn't pay the rent in his place, and we all ended up, and place had plenty of bedrooms, and we had a studio in above the basement where we could rehearse, and we had a pool table, and, you know, the Jed and Janice would come, and we all had parties over there. It was great. Still there.
Famous
old place.
Sounds so fun. Now, we haven't talked about Grace Slick yet. So when did she enter into the band? And how?
Well, she had her own band, the Grace Society, and they played a lot, and we played together a lot. And in fact, Grace would just sit right in front of the stage and watch me. It was very fun. She was very intent on staring you down, you know. And when we decided to let Sydney Anderson go, because she was pregnant, she didn't want to tour, and we're starting to get offers to tour and make money and go play, you know, Chicago or New York, and she didn't want to tour, so we had to let her go, and we wanted another girl, and there were only three girls working. There was Grace, she had her own popper band, and there was Janice, she had her own popper band, and she was real boozy, and there was Cold Blood, you know,
Lydia Pence.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it was about the only girls I knew working, and I said, you know, at the meeting, the only one I could imagine singing with would be Grace Slick, you know. She's not that weird, you know. So, or, you know, bougie. But she's got her own hit band with her husband and her brother in it. And Jack said, well, I don't care. I'm going to go ask her right now. So he went over and asked her in the afternoon, after a meeting, and that evening at our gig, Grace was on stage performing with.
Wow. So you really have an angel watching over you with everything that seems to go on with this band, I tell you. What year did you actually start the band? Do you remember?
65.
And then Grace joins what year?
I guess 67, something like that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So then things started to get pretty big, didn't they?
Oh, it got so big it was amazing. I couldn't even walk out of my house at the time on the street. You know, I mean, we were like, gods to people. You know, it was amazing.
Did that mess with your head at all?
It started to, you know, when my parents started to treat me kind of weird. I said, hey, it's just me, you know. Treat me like you always did, the old buck. And, you know, they calmed down, and I was home again. But it didn't mess with my head as much, because by the time it got really, really hurtful, and, you know, everybody stabs you in the back, and, you know, there's nobody you can really trust, even in your own band, you know. And in those days, everybody was on cocaine, you know, and meth. And, you know, I was a drinker and not much of a coke person, but people on coke were like crazy.
Yes.
And all these people were, you know, like even the roadies who worked for us was like, you know, like act like Hitler. It was crazy, you know, you couldn't talk to anybody.
It was pretty
aggressive. Especially my own band, you know. I would walk out and just look on the back of the amps. There'd be a pile of coke, pile of meth, little acid over here. I'd say, okay, I can see what kind of night this is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that when drugs started to become so overabundant, it sort of singed things back then, that sense of the summer of love, if you want to say, or that feeling of unity? Do you think that those drugs started to erode away on that?
Oh, yeah. I think the drugs have, because, you know, after that, I noticed the heroin, people came in, you know, all these kids on heroin, sleeping in Golden Gate Park, and, you know, on streets and Hate Street, and, you know, it was real sad to watch the growth of drugs. You know, and then acid, you know, was a big draw for people too. And, you know, one thing about the bands, we were taking the acid that was given to us by Alzer, you know, mm-hmm. himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pure, and I don't know what these kids were getting on the streets, you know.
Yeah. Remember window pane and...
Oh, God, yeah. That was even later. Then there's just little pills.
Yeah.
I can remember standing on the stage with a bag of acid pills and Grace with a bag of acid pills playing outdoors in L.A. Griffin Park, throwing these pills to these kids because acid wasn't illegal yet. And these kids just dancing naked in the mud before the stage. And the FBI watching us from the hills and the trees up above, and me pointing it out to people, hey, give a cheer to the FBI. Yay! FBI! Yelling. And, oh, I hate it. But it wasn't illegal yet. And so, it was, you know, it was crazy times.
Yes, crazy times. So, things got... have you read David Talbot's book, Season of the Witch? I think you're in it, right?
I don't know. I don't read that stuff.
Well, his book actually is a really interesting book in history. I've interviewed him. He talks about, he lives in San Francisco now, and he talked about when things started to get a little weird in San Francisco, a lot of musicians moved over to the county.
Right, I moved over in 68, yeah.
You moved to, where did you move, when you left San Francisco, when was it and where did you move?
Well, I moved right to 180 East Barstow, that little house on the corner. And I lived there and eventually bought that house and eventually renovated it. And the guy owns it now, ruined it, but... someday I'll buy it back and show them how it should be done.
It's the one over by Pharmaca Pharmacy, what used to be Lawson Dyer?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I had one right on the corner. Right across from Scott Hall.
Right across from Scott Hall, right.
Yeah.
So you went in 1968 to Mill Valley.
Yeah, I went right to Mill Valley.
What brought you to Mill Valley?
Well, I was going with a nurse, and we were living in the apartment in San Francisco, and she wanted to get a place care, you know, a nice place. And she came back and said she had this place. And it happened to be in Mill Valley. And when I saw the old house and the beautiful light and was warm over there every day, I said, hey, this is for me. I couldn't believe it because
Mm-hmm. Different weather over here.
Yeah, totally.
So you became a Mill Valley resident.
Oh, yeah. I fell right in. Loved it, you know. Had a great time there. And, you know, I had to, had a club there, Sweetwater, and I had, you know, bands living all around and music going on and a couple of restaurants and, you know, had a couple of bookstores, I remember, galleries. It was very quaint, you know, very simple.
Are you an outdoorsy guy?
Yeah, I love going up the mountain. I walk the mountain almost every day, me and my dog, you know. We hike up 18 miles up, 18 miles back. That was a great thing to do every day. I was young, I had a lot of energy, and I remember, you know, I quit the airplane for a while and hadn't joined the Starship yet. So I used that mountain a lot, you know, hiking and going through the valleys and, oh, yeah, beautiful, wonderful times.
What was your dog's name that you hiked with?
I was John Book.
John Book?
Book. People call him Book. B-U-K.
Oh.
But he was John Dog.
John Dog. So you and John Dog hit the trails. And there were, by then, what of your San Francisco friends had moved here?
Well, I remember Grace moved over eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a place up on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And,
the dead were here, right? They came later?
Dead, and, you know, some great writers and players, and Mike Bloomfield was there, and I remember Garcia dropping by sometimes, and, you know, we play music and share ideas, it was kind of fun. I had that house on the corner. It was always open. My doors were open in the summertime. You know, people came walking in all the time.
Did you ever have fans just show up?
Yeah, I had fans. I had one time, you know, I'd be sitting and watch the TV and you know, some girls looking through a window or something at me while me and my buddies are watching TV. Or, you know, I'd walk out and go, what are you doing, you know? Well, one time I had this fan pick up my garbage cans and throw them through my kitchen windows. You know, this giant crash. And the cops were very quick there in Novara.
Mm-hmm.
And they zoomed over. And this guy was a big fan of mine. And he just loved me so much, he wanted to tell me that. So he threw the garbage cans through my kitchen window to get my attention, I guess. You know, people like that every once in a while.
Didn't that bother you a little? I mean, you were on the main road there. Did you ever feel vulnerable?
No, I never did. You know, I never felt too threatened or anything. I always felt quite safe myself where I was.
That's nice. Did you know David Crosby? He was here in Mill Valley as well.
Yeah, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Janis Joplin didn't live too far away. She was in Larkspur, right?
Yeah. She come by sometimes with that painted Porsche of hers and give me a ride, take me riding, you know.
In that Porsche you had... Some people don't know about that Porsche. Would you mind describing Janis Joplin's Porsche to the listeners?
It was painted by some psychedelic artists to have had psychedelic designs over it. It was really sharp, kind of a cool-looking thing. I saw it years later at the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney Museum. They had a show, and they had that Porsche there. It was very interesting.
Was it hard for you when she died suddenly? I mean, you might
I was playing in Winterland, and I heard she died, and I could go. We had played Friday, and we were supposed to play Saturday at Winterland. And Friday, I thought I was so badly done, and everybody played so poorly, that I didn't want to go back Saturday. And then I heard she died, and I just went up the mountain with my dog and went to the top of Mount Cameron
That's how you greet for her, hmm? Hello?
Yeah.
So that's how you grieved. You took it to the mountain, hmm?
Yeah, but I couldn't go sing. I just felt so bad. It was funny, though. People came and filled my house and cooked and sat around and played music and sat with me and we sang songs and had food, and even Bill Graham, who had the winter line, came over and he saw how upset I was. He said, never mind coming, you'll have to sing. I think of him.
Mm-hmm. Sad to think about, even today, how sad it is to lose such wonderful people so young.
Yeah, especially when they were so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm sorry for your loss, too. She was a great musician.
God, I never saw anything like when Janis would sing Summertime. My God, I stand on stage and just feel it a shake. You know,
mm-hmm.
It was amazing.
I think I've heard that song 5,000 times. It is, her Summertime is, and I didn't get to see it live, but it is one of the most chilling and beautifully haunting songs.
Yeah. See her do it live, you know, be like, whoa, just like shattering.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. And then she'd walk off and, ha ha, how was that, Marty? Ha ha, you ever hear anybody sing as good as that? I go, no, yes, you're the best, you know.
You know, you have sung some pretty amazing ballads yourself, I have to say. Equally powerful in their own way. Coming Back to Me and Today. Did you write those songs when you were here in Mill Valley? Because whenever especially I hear Coming Back to Me, it really makes me think of Mill Valley. And I have always wondered if
actually, no, I was in Hollywood. Recording and I was recording with the airplane and I went back to the motel after the session and I ran into Paul Butterfield. Paul Butterfield, blues band guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul said, hey, Marty, smoke this, man. He gave me his joint. He rolled up. He said, this is the greatest stuff in the world. And so I went to my room and I smoked it, and I couldn't find my legs. I couldn't move. And I made it to my guitar, and out in 5 minutes came a song, Coming Back to Me. So I found my way to my car, went back to the studio, and they were just closing up. I said, wait, just a second, engineer. Turn on that machine. And I said, Grace was still there. And Jerry Garcia was there, and Jack Cassidy was there. I said, hey guys, play this with me. So we sat down, and one take, no rehearsal, we did the song, and that was it. And that was the recording I got used.
I'm seriously getting chills hearing that right now.
It just was one take, one moment, 5 minutes, it was written. And, you know, I just put down. But those are the good ones, you know, ones that come out quick.
Oh, my gosh. It's the most beautiful song.
And today we were in the studio, R.J. Victor at Sunset and Vine. And in Studio A was the Rolling Stones. And we were in Studio B. And in Studio C was Tony Bennett and his orchestra.
Tony Bennett! No!
Yeah. So me and the Stones, we all wanted to meet Tony Bennett, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, well, maybe I'll write him a song. that way I'll get to see him, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote today thinking of Tony Bennett kind of song, you know, that he might do. And I gave it to the drummer to give it to him. I don't know if he ever got it.
This is so interesting to hear the history behind these songs. Who would have thought today would be inspired by Tony Bennett and your appreciation for it? What a great musician. How about Miracles? Another great
song. Miracles, yeah, well, that was a strange pattern I was playing on guitar. And I was very involved with a avatar in India, Satya Sai Baba, and they call him the Man of Miracles. And I actually had darshan once with him in India. And I was my whole life was changed by him and what I read about him. And I began to write this song. I was very in love with the Persian poets and how they would write about God, but they would write about making love to a woman, and that woman was God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to write a song like that where it was about a woman, but there was a spiritual depth to it, and I was very involved with Sai Baba, so I began to just concentrate on Sai Baba and get myself into a trance and get that words come and flow through me. And it, after about 3 days, it did actually. And I got that song. I took it to the Starship and played it for them, and you know, got on one of the albums. And it became a big hit.
Yes. But I guess one of the biggest hits for the band, I'm a lover of ballads, so I will gladly talk about
it. A ballad's hard to do. People don't realize how hard a ballad can be.
Yes. Why is it hard? Tell me.
Well, you have to have a lot more control, you know. You know, when you're rocking, you know, you just, you know, there's that beat, that rockets, you know, vim you can never get out of, you know, and don't have to. You don't want to. But, you know, in a ballad, you know, you've got phrasing. You've got breath. You've got, you know, silences. You've got emotion. You can move a note, you know, to four or five different notes, you know, to express what you want. It's much more controlling, much more technique is involved.
Do you think you've been, that people have been less than supportive of your ballad performances versus your rock and roll? Because the Starship, White Rabbit is, you know, just one of those iconic songs. And it's got amazing beat, and it's so powerful. And then you've got these soft ballads. Have you ever taken any flack for mixing the two in your records?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. But, you know, people play my stuff just as much, so what do I care, you know?
You didn't write White Rabbit, though, did you?
No, I didn't. Grace did.
And how did it go with... You were the founder of Jefferson Airplane and lead singer, and then Grace comes in, and she's a very powerful personality in her own right, and the song was a huge hit. How was that during the band years? Was there ever a problem for you guys with the...
Oh, well, then, as soon as we had those hits, Somebody Loves White Rabbit, you know, I was the invisible man, and everybody was on their own, because, you know, nobody had a contract, nobody was in charge, and I never had anybody under contract or in charge.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally had nothing to say, and it became a madhouse, and that was pretty much as far as I could see the end of the band, because we made some records, but, you know, we never really lived up to the potential the band had. Everybody went off on their own. You know, Yama went to do his blues, and Paul is much dramatic, you know, powerful songs, which were fun to do, and which became all that we did pretty much at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And my ballads, one or two here and there. And I did actually write off a bunch of the rockers. So, you know, I had my share of fun.
Mm-hmm. And when you weren't playing in the band and you're living in Mill Valley, were you? Did you used to go visit Prune Music? I've interviewed Larry Craig, who owned Prune Music.
Yeah, I'd go by the. That was a quiet place.
That was a little small town music store.
Yeah, I wish I had bought more now when I think back.
Uh-huh. And there was, Larry talks about the back room at the Prune Music. Do you remember the back room at Prune Music where the musicians used to gather?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
I remember, but I don't think I ever was there that often.
How about, where are the places you used to like to hang out in Mill Valley? Were you a 2 a.m. man or at the Brothers?
Well, I went by a few times, and mainly Sweetwater and the Mill Valley bar on the corner, which is...
O'Leary's?
Yeah, I don't know what they call it then, but it was a bar where Bodacious took a photograph there for an album cover.
Mm-hmm.
I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Mill Valley Bar. But we hung out in there a lot. And yeah, that was it. And Sweetwater and 2 a.m. Club.
Do you used to go by the music store? John
Jones? Yeah.
How about the arts festival? Did you ever go to the art festivals in the old
mill? Oh, God. Yeah. It was great, especially when Whale was spectacular. And, you know, the Airplane played a lot of those, and even Starship. You know, I love playing those outdoor festivals around the bay. Mm.
Things have changed here in Mill Valley a little bit. We've got, there's more, you know, there's the Throckmorton Theater now. I think your friends...
I've been playing there, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I played there a few times. Mm-hmm. I love that place. Mm-hmm. You see, and I love playing at Throckmorton. In fact, I haven't gone back to Sweetwater or any of the rock clubs, even though I've been invited, because I enjoy the Throckmorton more than anywhere else.
What is it you like about it?
The ambiance, the vibrations in there, the history, the feeling I get when I work there.
Mm-hmm. You really are a bit of an intuitive, aren't you? You feel things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have to feel it. Mm-hmm. You know, he who feels it knows it, as Molly said.
He who feels it knows it?
Yeah.
Huh. And do you collaborate with other musicians here that are still in town? Are you still in touch with locals?
I am in touch when I come to town. I stay at Mill Valley Hotel now. I used to stay with my friends, but they sold a house up the hill. So, now I just stay in the Mill Valley Motel and, you know, travel around and go over to Frisco and see friends and do some shopping and just, you know, take it easy for a few days.
We've still got our musicians here, not as many as back in your day. I've interviewed a few. Lauren Rowan is actually...
I know. I just recorded one of his songs.
You did? You just recorded one of his songs?
Yeah.
Oh, which song was that?
Sleepwalking and Gold.
And Gold?
A song called Gold.
Oh, yes. So we're blessed still with some local performers. He's quite active, and others are active in the area. You know, Bill Champlin grew up here, too. Did you know him?
Yeah, I'm gone. Yeah, the Sons of Champlin were the scariest rock band on earth, my God. If all the bands I ever saw were heavy, they were a heavy band.
Were they?
Oh, yeah. They could rock the place apart.
I'll have to tell them you said so.
Oh, yeah, man. It was, yeah, a scary band. Sons of Champlin. Uh-huh. Oh.
Funny, knowing Bill now, I can hardly imagine that. Such a more affable man you'll never meet. Uh-huh.
Well, it was with those young days, the glory days.
Uh-huh. When you think back, you've had such a, you could say, glamorous life. I mean, at the very least, you are a very gifted, creative person who's actually been able to actualize your gift. I mean, to live your gift, so many artists have to work another job to do what they want to do, and they scramble.
Yeah, I've been lucky, very lucky. But I'm still recording. I'm working on an album now with a bunch of people down here, a bunch of musicians, and I go play down here, and I come out to Throckmorton a couple times a year. I used to until last year, but I'll be back, and go to the Cubs and up to Seattle and down to L.A. and go play a few places. I get my rocks off that way, and people come out. Actually, it's very fun.
I see here in Mill Valley with a lot of the performers from back in the day are performing, and their fan base is just as strong as ever. Everybody looks a lot older, but they're still rocking.
Yeah.
Is that what you find with your performances as well?
Well, I have up to last year, but I haven't played all year, so I took the whole year off this year.
You've had some
cooking,
health issues.
Recording, and just relaxing. I had enough touring for a while with the Starship, I'll tell you.
How about, we didn't talk about Starship. We talked about Airplane. Do you want to talk a little bit about the switch over from Airplane to Starship?
Well, I left the Airplane, and eventually Yom and Jack and others left, and Paul and Grace, who were a team, mates, they performed together for a while and started making recordings and put together the Jefferson Starship to update it. They updated the name, and it's funny, I read the reviews of the recordings and the live shows, and the reviewers would go, "Oh, I miss the days when Marty and Grace would sing together. Oh, I miss the days when Marty and Paul would write the songs together, Oh, I miss the days, So I thought, one of these days, they're going to come knocking on my door. And sure enough, one of these days, Paul come knocking on my door and said he had a piece of music he wanted to know if I would write the lyrics for. And I said, sure, So I wrote Caroline for him, and I sang it on the album for him, and they were touring and trying to do that song, and David Freiberg was trying to do it, couldn't do it. So I came back from a tour and said, "You've got to join a band because we can't do that song," and it was getting airplay, So I said, "Well, I will join if you let me do my kind of songs," which was, Miracles, Count on Me, stuff like that, Wish Your Love, Runaway, So, they said, okay, whatever. So, I came and I brought Miracles to them. And at first they all were like, "I don't know about that, man. That's pretty weird, So even the record company said, "Oh, you've got to put Grace on all over." So I knew Grace hated seeing the words "baby" or "I love you" or any of those kind of sentiments in a song. So behind the song of Miracles, I had her going, "Baby, baby, baby, I love you, I love you." All these icky sentiments. She couldn't say anything, But she did, and it was a crack up. But so she was all over the record and got all the attention for the record, actually. But anyway, that was a lot of fun. And we put strings on, which was a new idea. And they got, people laughed at it, but suddenly it was on the air, and it was everywhere,
I remember well.
Yeah, and every station played it, and every time they play it, they say, "That's Grace Strick and the Jefferson Starship." Never once would they mention my name. Boy, that pissed me off.
Ouch.
But nobody cared. Same old, same old. I always got shafted. But I was used to it by then, you know. As long as the royalty check came to me and not Grace, I couldn't care less.
Uh-huh.
I learned to live with it.
And you have your own life. We haven't talked much about your personal life, but you know, the rock and roll world has got all kinds of temptations, but yet some people manage to have relationships and families. Did that work out for you, or?
No. It didn't until about 6 years ago when I met the perfect woman. But up till then, I just, you know, was always singing and concentrating really on myself, you know, being kind of selfish, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I devoted enough time to a woman to have a real solid girlfriend. But I had some good relationships for a while, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't anything that lasted and held true.
But now you've got Sue in your life.
Now I've got Sue in my life, yeah.
And I know Sue because we've been collaborating about this interview for months now. She's the one that really made it happen.
Yeah, she's a wonderful woman, I must say.
Yes.
Gave me the urge to keep on going and keep on living and keep on creating. And my God, I have so many new songs and, you know, ideas and things I want to do with her. And we're a great team, you know, so. It's wonderful to find that person that you can really, you know, create with and love and see things and travel with. And, you know, it's just so wonderful to share everything and have the same feelings and desires. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say opposites attract. Well, so do the same old, I tell you. Find someone who's got the same likes. Makes it much easier.
Looking back now on your life and the various iterations of the different selves you've been over time, as we all change through time, would you have done anything different?
Oh, yeah, of course. I would have signed contracts with people, for one thing, you know. I never was one to sign contracts and got away with it for a while. But, you know, I was living that hippie ideal. And, you know, but everybody took me for a ride because of it. So, you know, I would have conducted business much differently. But, you know, I got something out of it. And I have a nice home and a nice life. I don't have to worry about, you know, struggling and hitting the road every month just to make the nest and keep a band going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people I'm playing with now, they're not, you know, holding it over my head to make them a living, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They play because they want to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're at that age where all of us don't give a damn, you know. It's a great age to be. We play music because we love it. And we play what we want.
When you were a young, hot rock star, and you could you have imagined thrusting yourself into the future that you'd still be rocking at an older age?
I always imagined it.
It always
you
was.
Yeah, you know, because you know, when I grew up, I saw the older performers, and you know, where would I have been if I couldn't have seen Muddy Waters, Lightning Hopkins, you know, all the greats, Donnie Hooker, Ed James, Ray Charles. I mean, I got to grow up on these people. My God, you know.
Now you're one of those people. What would you say to the young people listening today, the musicians? It's a wholly different world now, but yet they may have the same passions and impulses you did as a young person.
Follow your passion. You know, you can do anything and communicate to the whole world now. It doesn't really matter. You know, do it from your bedroom. You know, anything you want to express. You know, it's amazing. You know, I mean, I can make a record from my I have a bedroom that I converted to a studio, you know, called Marilyn Monroe Studios. And, you know, so I needed computers and little devices, and I make a whole album, you know, right there next door and send it out to the whole world. You know, it's amazing.
Hmm. Any words of advice about being out? What if someone starts to make it? I have one of my son's friends is doing quite well in the music world. Any words of advice you'd say to someone that's starting to get a level of fame?
Just, you know, words I always held on to were, what gain for man who gains for the world who loses his soul? I always held on to that.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of guided me through, you know. I had a lot of spiritual guidance in my life. You know, I was always guided by spiritual people and spiritual things, and held true to, you know, my gurus and my avatar. And in the heyday, and you know, I just, you know, felt like it was raining off a duck's back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought, you know, words of advice from my guru, you know, he who sees no importance could never lose any. You know, so I didn't really seek importance. All I thought was, I just want to become a great singer and learn as much as I can and do as much as I can. You know, I really don't care about the fame or, you know, the hell with it. Give these people a credit. I don't care. Just send a check to me and let me sing.
Do you?
You know, I've seen giant photographs of Grace Slick on stage, and then down in front of her, real tiny, hanging on the lip of the stage, will be me, leading the crowd to the song, you know. But on the picture, it'll say Grace Slick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't even mention me, but down there, leading the crowd, who Grace Slick is waiting to join, is me, you know. So I'm there, I just didn't get to mention.
Mm-hmm. When did you leave Mill Valley, Marty?
About 99, I had a baby girl in Florida from with a woman, and the girl had spinal bifida.
Spinal bifida, right?
Yeah, and needed care, you know, and such a great kid. I just wanted to be with her more, and she has a wheelchair and crutches, and, you know, San Francisco and Mill Valley is not exactly the best place for a wheelchair person.
Mm-hmm.
So out here it's flat and easy for her, and so I began to come out here more and more, you know.
To Florida.
Yeah, and I just, you know, eventually got a condo, and then I bought a house out here, and bought a big house where she'd be comfortable, and kind of live my life for her anymore.
That's daddy's love.
Well, it's payback is enormous.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think about coming back to Mill Valley? Does Mount Tam call to you?
Well, I'd love to buy my house on East Barstow again and fix it up the way I always envisioned it, and make it the beautiful home it should have been. And, I think about Mill Valley. I love Mill Valley. It's just, you know, it got so cold. I couldn't take it. I'd go to rehearsal every day. I'd have to go to a tanning booth and lay in a tanning booth before rehearsals. I got so cold. I'm one of those people who can't take cold. And you know, the weather down Florida keeps me fine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's always warm. People don't wear much clothes here. It's very tropical and very pleasant and very flat for a wheelchair girl, my girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, beneficial. But, you know, eventually I'm getting to travel with her, so we'll take her out there. Because I want her to see San Francisco and Mill Valley and, you know, great places. But, you know, if I have extra money, I'd love to buy a new home in Mill Valley and come stay there and so summer. There's nothing like Indian summer in Novi. Mm-hmm.
Smell those bay leaves.
Yeah. You know, and the film festival up your way. And great restaurant. I love D'Angelo's. My favorite.
Yes, and the art festival under the Redwoods.
Yeah, art festival under the Redwoods. Man, you don't get stuff like that out here. You get strangers, you know, but there's something about the others out there, you know, the people.
Yes. Well, if you ever decide to come back, Mill Valley will be very happy to have you and your family.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Yes. Well, Marty, I think that about wraps it, unless there's something we haven't talked about that you wish we had. Is there anything we've missed here in this conversation?
No, just look for my new albums.
Yes.
I got new stuff come out. And go on my website, and you'll probably pick up on my new stuff. Keep up with me, because I'll be out to Throckmorton again probably end of this year, I bet.
And your website is MartyBallonMusic.com.
MartyBallonMusic.com.
And there you are. I just brought you up, and there you are as a young man in those hip clothes you were talking about. And there you are now, I believe. I can't quite tell. And all that beautiful art. So that's good to know. And thank you so much for sharing your story, Marty. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you
so much. Talking to me and thinking, you know, I could be a part of the history. It's an honor. It really is.
You are absolutely part of our history. You're the part of the history of millions and millions. I'm a California girl born and bred. Your music is in my bones, as all my friends and almost everybody I know. You're a part of us all. And for
that,
I'm
in your DNA.
Yes, you're in our DNA. So thank you so much, Marty. It's been great.
All right.
Come back to
me. Send me a copy, if you will.
You will be getting a copy of this audio and the transcript.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty.
All right, Debbie, you have a great year and summertime, and I appreciate you calling me.
Thank you so much, and keep on rocking, Marty. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.